You've heard of BetaShares. You've probably seen the logo on our podcast. You might even be among their 1 million investors. So you can imagine that I'm delighted to say BetaShares is the official ETF partner of the Australian Finance Podcast. With nearly 100 exchange-traded funds, you can go to betashares.com.au and immerse yourself in ETFs and unique insights covering all of the sectors, themes, core and satellite positions you could want. Think cybersecurity through the HACK ETF, robotics and AI with the RBTZ ETF, and uranium with the URNM ETF. The list goes on. To explore the BetaShares ETF range, visit betashares.com.au, read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website, and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer. Welcome to the Australian Finance Podcast.
I'm Kate Campbell.
And I'm Owen Rask.
And we're here to give you the tools and knowledge to invest both your time and money better.
If you're new, feel free to jump in with our Starter Pack series that aired in early 2022, or our Shares or ETF mini series.
We've got plenty to share with you in today's episode, but if you want to catch us on socials,
head to Rask Australia on Insta and Twitter.
I'm also found at Kate Campbell AUS on Insta.
And I'm Owen Rask AU on Insta.
Just beware of the fake accounts. We'll never DM you about trading strategies or crypto. And if it sounds a bit weird, it's probably not us.
And just one final heads up before we get into the show. This podcast contains general financial information only. Alex, how are you going, mate?
Very well, mate. How are you?
Good. Back to record a Q&A episode for the podcast. And it's always a bit of fun because I give you a few hypotheticals. There's a bit of an actionable takeaway at the end. And of course, everyone gets a chance to ask a proper financial advisor their questions. Mate, you know that we have a bit of fun at the start. I've got two would you rathers. So,
sounds good. Yep.
Number one is, would you rather a one-bedroom apartment in Sydney? Now, I know you're a Perth boy, so would you rather a one-bedroom apartment in Sydney or a 20-acre farm in the Queensland Tablelands? For anyone playing along at home, Queensland Tablelands is inland Cairns, and it's beautiful.
I'm a Perth boy, but I have family in Sydney, so I have spent a fair bit of time over there. I'm going to answer this from two sort of angles, an investment perspective and then a lifestyle perspective.
So
I think from an investment perspective, I'm going to assume this is a half decent apartment in Sydney, which I would probably prefer over the land at this point in time, given it's probably going to be worth, you know, $1.5 million, and I'm probably going to be able to get a pretty good yield on the rent currently. So I'll take that from the investment perspective. But yeah, from the lifestyle perspective, I think the 20-acre farm would be beautiful.
Oh yeah, and yeah, that's all fair enough. I mean, both have their perks, and if you've got a family or something like that, a 20-acre farm, and if you could do your job remotely, as we are recording, I'm in Melbourne, you're in Perth right now. I know you've got the team all over the country. If you could do that, why not? Second question, and this is more for the daydreamers out there like me. Would you rather three weeks of road tripping around Italy or 6 weeks around Australia?
I'm going to pick Italy in this instance. So I've done a little bit of the coast in Italy, and it was beautiful. The reason I simply pick it is because we are very blessed. We obviously both live in Australia. I've been fortunate enough to explore a lot of Australia as well, but Italy is obviously, you know, the coastline's quite different to over here. So I would pick it just simply because of for that reason, that it's quite different to what we're sort of used to over here.
Respect. And I think a lot of people sitting at home will be like, Australia, we do take for granted what we have in our home country. It is absolutely divine. But 3 weeks in Italy sounds pretty good, especially as we face coming into a winter. Mate, so we are going to answer some questions. We've got some great questions sent in with some funny names. If you want to know how to send your question in, there's a thing that says ask a question. It's in your podcast player. It is also available on any of the Rask websites in the menu at the top. Just ask a question. I think one of the websites says my question. You just click that and it takes you through a form. We are answering this question for all of the Rask podcasts because typically Alex and I, when we do these Q&As, they're relevant to every channel of the Rask group. So no matter where you get your Rask podcast, chances are it will appear. But typically the easiest way to do it is to select the Australian Finance Podcast because Kate is the arbiter of the questions typically for this show. As always, we don't know your personal circumstances, so get in touch with a financial advisor who can take into account your needs, goals, or objectives. And if we mention things like ETFs or super funds, be sure to read the product disclosure statement or PDS, which can be available, which is available on the product provider's website. We say that because we can only answer questions generally. So try and make it easy for us. Don't give us your full life situation or specific goals and that type of thing. The first question comes from Taxman's best friend. Hey, Owen and team. My question is tax related. My partner works in the mining industry and has a high income. Let's just say 3 to 4 times the average salary per year before tax. It's a pretty good income, I might say, Alex. He is simply employed by a company, and this is his wage. And as you'd be aware, this comes with considerable tax. How can we reduce his income tax? Is there any way to offset it so that we may not be aware of? More specifically, can slash should my partner use, for example, a company or an ABN and then subcontract off his employer if possible and thus claim the tax-related benefits? This is a very into-the-weeds question, but it's one that a lot of people do think about. They think, well, I'm earning a pretty decent wage, and they see their tax bill every year. They're like, yeesh, is there anything I can do about it? Obviously, very topical recently with some not-so-friendly changes for high-income earners at the political level. Mate, what do you think?
Yeah, so it's a it's a pretty common question that we get from time to time. And yeah, obviously, the more money you make, the more tax you pay, effectively. We have a progressive tax system here in Australia, so that's effectively how it works. So I think a lot of people naturally get to sort of a certain point in terms of their earnings and go, hey, I'm actually shelling out a fair bit in tax here. Is there anything I can sort of do to minimize this? Unfortunately, the answer is there are some things you can do, but there's not heaps of things that you can do if you are an employee. So some things that, you know, this person may hypothetically consider, maybe adding additional super contributions to help sort of reduce their income. Now, obviously, if they are earning that higher amount, it's likely that their employer contribution is going to be pretty close to the cap anyway. So there's not necessarily a lot of wiggle room there to reduce it too much further. You know, any sort of work deductible expenses, so tools that they may need for work or anything like that, it's important to look at that because you could potentially get a deduction for that as well, which helps sort of reduce the tax. But in terms of this main sort of, like you said, in the weeds gray area around, can I just turn around and become a subcontractor, you know, through a company or a sole trader style arrangement, and then contract back to my existing place of employment, because then I may be able to claim additional tax deductions. The answer is no, really. So there's a thing called personal services income. So this effectively, and don't quote me on this, but I believe this basically came about because a bunch of IT people effectively tried to do this in the 90s or started to do this. So one day they were working for, I don't know, whoever it was, let's just say Microsoft or something like that, as an employee on Friday. And then Monday they turned around and became a subcontractor. So they were able to claim, you know, potentially like a car expense or basically additional expenses to reduce their taxable income as a result. However, personal services income, where that basically comes in is it's effectively saying that if your more than 80% of your income is generated from one source, then you are effectively then treated as an employee because you're not a true company or a true subcontractor in this case, because a subcontract would definitely typically have, you know, multiple clients that they work for, not just the one.
Yep. There are very stringent rules that apply to this stuff called personal services income. I kind of find it interesting that it's called personal services income and not professional services income, which is what I called it once. But it's kind of like it is typically for professionals who see an opportunity to say, hey, I'm earning X up here and it's very high. I'm on 47% tax or whatever. I notice that the company is paying, say, roundabout figures, 25 or 30%. Can I just bill through that? And that we had a similar thing. If you go back even further, Alex, you go back to like the family trust days, people used to spin up family trusts and send money to their partner or to their kids and try and get around other things. And you had an introduction of different tax laws around kids and minors' income. And basically, there's not an easy answer to this straight away. Question for you, maybe catching you a bit off guard here. Let's say, for example, you are earning like 500 grand a year. There's a wonderful wage, right? Absolutely wonderful. So your employer is going to be contributing, say, roundabout figures, 10% of that. So 50 grand, say, just for round figures, to your super fund, which is obviously above the 27,500 limit. My understanding, I could be wrong, sometimes I believe that extra amount can be withdrawn from super because it's excess tax. Is that correct?
Geez, that is catching me off guard slightly. I think, and I would need to double check this in all honesty, but there is, to be honest, actually, I think even with the employer, there is a limit that they can be legislated to actually contribute per quarter as well.
That's right. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
So there's something to do with that in terms of how much they have to actually put in. But I believe, yeah, in essence, you are correct in that you don't necessarily have to breach that cap. That can just come to you as additional income. However, obviously, it would be taxed at the 47.5% rate in that example. So you basically will lose half.
Yep. I think this is, and for folks that don't know, I've just done, Google is like friend in this instance. For the person that's listening to this, there are certain things that apply. It's called Division 293 tax, and it's for higher income earners. You should Google this and speak to your advisor. In fact, you probably should just get advice and ask this question to your advisor because they'll be able to help you. Division 293 tax, and it applies with people that earn over a certain amount of income and do contribute a lot to their super fund because there may be benefits in that way. Other things which maybe if we kind of take a step aside from the kind of I earn a lot of money, what can I do, is maybe there are investments that are tax friendly for you. So I'm thinking of things like negatively geared properties. I'm thinking of things like your primary place of residence, which you do not pay capital gains tax on. I'm thinking of things like franking credits, which are wonderful investments of that basically tax paid type dividend income or tax credits. And maybe then they're setting up today thinking, is my partner going to be in their job for a long time? We're going to be on a high income tax. Maybe you can create an investment portfolio through a family trust. And maybe... Yeah.
Another thing to consider as well would be potentially an investment bond as well, maybe worthwhile.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's basically a structure which pays the company rate. There's a few sort of rules and things to sort of consider around that, but that can be quite a good benefit to a high income earner if they can't sort of distribute the income elsewhere. Because yeah, super is not really an option because that's already being maxed out. So it's potentially your next best option again, depending on your situation. But you're right. It's effectively thinking about, okay, I am going to get taxed a fair bit, which, you know, obviously means you're earning good money, which again, hopefully leads to meaning that you have a decent surplus so you are able to invest. So then it's being as smart as you can from a tax structuring point of view with that investment, whether it's putting it in the spouse's name because maybe the spouse is earning significantly less as an example, so they're on a lower tax bracket, or again if they're, or like a family trust as you said before as well, or yeah, an investment bond, looking at that investment property to get that negative gear to get some additional tax deductions there as well.
So it's about kind of like, yeah, you may not be able to avoid the tax now, but if you are using that cash that does hit your bank account in the future to make a return, which is wonderful if you can, and you should be probably, how can you then structure those investments for the benefit of yourselves longer term? And there are many different things you can do. And if you need help, speak to your financial advisor, speak to your tax agent, all those professionals around you. The next question came from Sue, and I wasn't sure the context of this episode that they're referring to. So I don't know exactly, Alex. So they say, in the personal insurances episode, the guest speaker said that all insurers pay the same commission, which I read as meaning brokers would not be biased by the commission. However, I've not been able to find anything on the web that confirms this is the case. In fact, most links I've found talk about varying commissions. Where should I go to understand this? And I'm just going to add some context here. It may have been the episode that Kate did, which was on personal insurance not too long ago, but it may have also been the recent brokerage episode, mortgage broking episode, in which case we spoke about how mortgage brokers make their money when they help you find a loan. They earn a commission from that, in which case most of those are quite standardized these days. There's an upfront fee and then a little trailing commission that goes along with that. So that is pretty standardized as far as I'm aware. Alex, this is maybe more of an insurance thing, but I'm just curious if you had a take on this.
Yeah, so I think it's good to sort of clear this up because it's important, right? We want to have the transparency if, you know, if someone's doing some work for you or providing you some advice or implementing something for you and they're not being paid through, you know, a fixed fee or, you know, Owen, it's going to be $3,000 for me to do this for you. It's important that you understand then how they're effectively paid. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so mortgage brokers are typically paid by the lender. They still, you know, they still have to act in your best interest and prove why it's better for you to go with lender A over lender B, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. In the mortgage broking world, like you said, the commissions that they receive is relatively standard. It is not exact though for every single lender. However, the spread is tiny. Okay, in terms of the difference between, say, the top paying one and the bottom paying one. And again, just to reemphasize, they have to act in your best interest. Okay, so there is that overlay first and foremost. Mm-hmm. In the financial advice world or the financial planning world, we will typically help people with personal insurances. So this is like income protection, TPD, life insurance. We receive a commission from the insurer for completing that work for clients. Every insurer pays the exact same commission rate in the financial advice world. Okay, so there is no difference. There is no spread, albeit however tiny, in the mortgage broking world. In the financial advice world, it is exactly the same between insurer A and insurer B. So hopefully that clears that up.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you, mate. And that's there's been a lot of change to these types of situations in recent years, but there was a lot of pushback, a lot of toing and froing between industry advocates, advice groups, and even consumer advocates, to be honest, because what we've found is that if everyone had to pay for all of the mortgage broking services up front, they probably wouldn't do it. So they would end up going to the bank, and the bank's only going to give them advice on their own mortgages and not allow them to compare. And then the same for insurance. It's very, very hard to get insurance advice in Australia, and not a lot of people are willing to pay to get advice to pay for insurance. So by having these structures in place, it actually makes it easier to get the thing that you actually do want for your financial situation. So that's a great question, Sue. I hope that does help clear things up. Ali writes in and says, this was quite an interesting one, and we're going to keep this general in our response. I've been living overseas and have just moved back to Oz, and I have about $100,000 sitting in an offshore account in US dollars, doing nothing, gasp, they say. The question I can't find the answers to is about diversifying in currency. I could easily just transfer it all back to AUD, get a bump on the exchange rate now, or try to find a way to keep that money in USD in some investment vehicle. I haven't solved for that either, other than limited investment options through the bank holding the cash. I may be overthinking this and not wanting to make a dumb mistake is holding me back from just putting this somewhere for the long term and forgetting about it. Alex, we have so many people in the RAS community who do spend time abroad or go over, say, the US, Europe for work or whatever the case may be. Maybe have a super fund, maybe have this, maybe have that. But in this instance, they've just got cash sitting in US dollars. Thoughts?
So yeah, well, obviously this is general, and we'll make some assumptions here as well.
Absolutely.
I guess my first thought when thinking about this is really, where am I going to be for the next couple of years, or, you know, potentially sort of the long term? So I'm going to assume, based on this question, that they've spent some time in the US, made some money, and now they've moved back home to Australia, where they sort of intend to be for the long term. If that's the case, if it was me personally, and this is just me, I would potentially want to have the funds here in my home country. And the reason for that is sort of, I guess, well, maybe three reasons for that. Firstly, it's like ease of access. So obviously if it's in a bank account here in Australia, I've got access to it immediately. Obviously you can transfer the money from the US, but that will take some time, and you're going to have currency risk depending on what the dollar is doing on that particular day. Secondly, from a control point of view, so again, basically having it domiciled here in the country that I live in will give me a lot better control over that money. And the third one, I guess, well, which is sort of, again, maybe combines two things, is like the admin perspective and the tax perspective as well. So if you've got, foreign investments, again, that's going to add additional admin to when you complete your tax return every year. There's additional forms that you'll probably have to fill out. Not to mention, again, this, I guess, from the practicality point of view as well. So if they, say, did want to invest that over there in the US, do they need to engage an advisor over there because they want a particular sort of product? Or if they're buying a property over there, then they're obviously, again, dealing with you know, an agent over there and a property manager. So it just adds, in my opinion, a lot more sort of unnecessary, perhaps, complexity, particularly if they are looking to, say, invest for the long term. So they want to get a, you know, a series of ETFs or index funds, which, you know, the majority of a lot of that can be accessed on the ASX these days. You don't need to have that in the US.
Yeah, you don't need to invest in the US companies to have to and have the money over there. It can be here in Australia.
That's right.
Thanks to ETFs and the brokers here in Australia. I've got a lot of friends that are from the US, and then they move to Australia either semi-permanently or permanently, and the mess that it causes them to have to do two tax returns is unbelievable. Like, it's actually it's so complicated. That it's almost just not worth it. And now, the only thing, I had a friend, the only reason that he would keep those tax returns and doing everything in the US is because he was going to move back there. He had like a life that he was going back to. But other than that, like, I just think this gets so complicated. You have to engage professionals on two sides. If you start building serious wealth, like, it becomes too much. So, great question. We have a lot of people that talk about that want to exfil money from Europe, maybe they've got some money in the UK, or maybe they've got some money in the US or Canada where they've worked. Seek the advice of a financial advisor in that situation. It's one of those sticky situations. There was a related question here, which is from Falcon. If my broker accesses Australia and the US, and they're using Stake in this regard, the popular trading platform, what is the difference, pros and cons, of buying an Australian ETF that tracks the S&P 500, the USA's biggest companies, versus, say, a US ETF, so like in the United States, that tracks the S&P 500. So you could buy the ETF in Australian dollars on the Australian Stock Exchange, which is IVV for those people that don't know the ticker symbol, or you could go onto the US version of the Stake platform and buy the S&P 500 ETF. I can't remember the ticker symbol off the top of my head. I'm not sure if it's QQQ or something like that, but they buy either one. What's the main difference?
So the main difference is just where it's domiciled for tax. The underlying investment is exactly the same at the end of the day, which I assume are like, you know, aligns with the goal in this hypothetical situation. So again, if it was me, for simplicity, and as we sort of just talked about, and keeping our admin costs down, and, you know, keeping it simple, yeah, you would go the Australian ETF version of the S&P 500. Because with the American one, you're going to have to fill out what's called a W-8 BEM form as well. There's just, a lot more admin work that you have to do, which is effectively unnecessary because at the end of the day, it's the exact same investment.
Yeah. Jordan asked a very similar question. Is it better to invest in Australian ETFs versus US ETFs? And what we're inferring from this question, Jordan, is that an investor might want to just invest in the same one, similar to Falcon's question. And again, with Alex's point, you oftentimes find that there is an Australian and a US version. I always opt for the Australian version myself, even if there is a little bit of extra fees, because I do not want the admin and I like to see everything in one place. It makes it easy for tracking through like Nvexa or ShareSite or whatever tool you use to automatically track your portfolio. I just much rather that. Now, if you're suggesting in this question, Jordan, should you invest in ETFs that invest in the US market or the Australian market? That's a very different question. So if you want the top Australian shares in your ETF or the top US shares, I've been doing this for years. My approach has always been, why not both?
Yeah.
There was a question here, which is from Wheelie Dan. This is a good one, I think, Alex. And it says, they've given us a bit of information. They're a young person. They said they've got a HEX debt. We get a lot of questions about this, and particularly this was like Triple J's number one finance segment for like 2 years running because inflation was high and everyone was getting their panties in a knot about this. They're carrying a bit of a HEX debt, which for those of you that don't know is the Australian equivalent of a quote-unquote student loan. You get it from the government when you go to uni and that sort of a thing. They say it is now worth more than my savings. I have been attempting to save this year and have also dabbled investing on Perla. Full disclosure, Perla is a long-term sponsor of the Australian Finance Podcast. But I am not sure if I should just be focusing on paying off the debt. It seems like it will take me years at this rate and don't want to be at square one in my 30s. So, HEX debt, paying it down, thoughts?
Yeah, there's many ways you can kind of, I guess, approach this. I think it, again, comes back to what you're sort of looking to do over the next couple of years. So like you said, the reason HEX has become very popular the last couple of years is because inflation's been quite high. So every year, your HEX loan will be indexed at whatever the inflation rate was for that 12 months. So, you know, last year it was around 7%, I think, or 6 to 7%. Whereas in years gone by, prior to that, it's been obviously very low because inflation's been very low as a result. I think as well, it's important to consider that typically someone, say, in their mid-20s may have just finished university. They may be 1 to 2 years, maybe 3 years into their career. So they are going to be junior as well, so which is normally obviously reflected in their earnings. Okay, so as you do earn more each year, you will be obligated to pay more HEX back. So it's important to think about, I guess, that career trajectory to a degree, because right now, you know, it may seem scary looking at that large sort of number, but as your income does grow over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, as you again mature more in your career, there more of your money is basically going to go towards paying that off, which, you know, said in theory will get rid of it, as an example. Again, though, it comes back to, like, is it a better choice now to maybe put my savings and just get this thing gone? But you may be saving for a house, as an example. You know, you may have more shorter term goals as well in terms of taking a holiday and things like that as well. So obviously taking that savings and clearing that debt or part of that debt is then going to delay that. I guess with the house as well, it is important to consider that with your borrowing capacity, HEX does come into it too. So again, have a chat with a mortgage broker if that is a goal of yours, because sometimes, for example, you might have $5,000 of HEX left and it is worthwhile, say, just paying that off so you can get that extra bit of borrowing capacity as well. So yeah, there's a few things to consider. I guess the other one as well, like sometimes we talk to clients that, yeah, the money may be better put somewhere else from a numbers perspective, but psychologically they just don't like it hanging over their head, which is important, I think, as well. So in which case we may just clear it simply so, again, they feel better about it, knowing that it's gone, and they can, again, just now focus on that next goal and pour all their resources into that.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I like that. The I would concur with you and say that if you're trying to buy a house in the next few years, that is probably the major roadblock that is the major goal that HEX can sometimes put a roadblock in front of. And the reason is, for folks that don't know, and I've got the latest numbers in here in front of me, I just pulled them up. If you earn below $51,550, so $51,000 for round figures, if you earn below that, you actually don't pay anything in HEX repayments, zero. If you earn $100,000, 6.5% of your income is going to be directed to repaying that loan from the government. So the more you earn, the more you pay back. And it's basically pretty intuitive. Like, it's a loan, but the government isn't going to sting you if you don't earn as much. And there was a time in years gone by, you may remember, Alex, maybe you look a bit younger than me, so maybe you don't remember this one. Maybe I'm showing my age. But
yeah, implying I'm old, but I am old, so fair enough.
There was a time when some people would get a loan to study something at university and they would go into employment but never reach the threshold, and so they would never, ever pay back the HEX. And that's okay. That's maybe what the system's there for, in a sense, in that, like, obviously the system wants you to pay it back. But there was a lot of people getting angry about their HEX loans in 2022 when inflation went up. And I think I'm all aboard people getting access to education, but I also think it was a fantastic opportunity for people to pay absolutely no gratitude and to show no sense of appreciation for the wonderful country that we live in, where you can study at some of the world's best universities. Then you go into an economy where you can get paid well, and then you complain that you do have to pay back the loan, the cost of getting into that job and living in this country. And so I think my opinion on some things is quite controversial. And I think if you study and you choose to go down that path, wonderful, go and earn a lot of money and pay back that HEX if you want to. And the beautiful thing is you don't have to pay extra if you don't want to. So it's, and if we apply the financial lens, on average, inflation for HEX has gone up between 2 and 3% over the past 5 to 10 years. So it is a very low cost over time. Yes, in 1 year, it might have gone up 7% or 6% or whatever it was. But over time, it is a very low cost. And I think there are often bigger challenges in your financial life than paying back HEX early. But that said, like if you need to get a home loan, typically a broker will give you advice on whether you should pay it back because you will actually have a higher after-tax income if you pay it off earlier. So that's my rant. That's more of a rant than an answer to this question.
I think it's a good one. Good rant. No, good rant. I liked it. Yeah. No, I think as well, like I can remember, being in my mid-20s, it was 10 years ago, so you can figure out my age based on that. And looking at my HEX at that point in time and also being like, man, when am I ever going to pay this off? But again, I've now got a little bit more perspective, maybe slightly more wisdom, maybe less. But, it does. And I actually remember, to be honest, my boss telling me at that point in time, like, don't worry about it. It'll be gone before you know it. And thinking like, yeah, right. Like, you know, I think I owed 30 or 40 grand or something like that. But he was right. So he had the wisdom. And, you do wake up a couple of years later and it is gone. And like you said, it's, I think the costs of university in this country are pretty reasonable compared to the rest of the world. The system is pretty lenient that you are never going to sort of earn above that sort of 50K mark. You don't in theory have to pay it back either.
Yeah. I think maybe one thing, just understanding the system, if I could teach a young person one thing, it would just be to understand how it works and why it works the way that it does. Obviously, depending on the course that you choose, whether it's Commonwealth supported place will depend on ultimately what your HEX bill is. And the government effectively puts those Commonwealth supported places into the system, which is basically, for those that don't know, you get a substantially reduced HEX bill because the government actually just straight out pays for part of your course, your tuition. And the reason that they do that is they subsidize the jobs that are most in demand and the country really needs. So it's their way of kind of nudging people towards the careers that they believe are most in demand and will be for a very long time. So like nurses, teachers, doctors to an extent still pay a shed load of HEX, but that's another thing. But the idea is engineering, technology, these types of things. If you go into those, if you use that as your guide, it almost means that you get a lower HEX bill and you get a job that's probably more guaranteed in terms of the income. So you can use that kind of nudge to your advantage. But great question. I still have a HEX bill and I still seem intent on racking it up with every extra piece of study that I do. But that's just my take. Some people will probably disagree with us on that. All right, we've probably got time for one last question here before I get your hot take and your action point for this week, Alex. It's from Grillbug. It doesn't sound that tasty. And there's two questions in one, and they are total polar opposites. So this is going to be a bit of fun. So the two questions are, is lithium still a good stock to hold? That's the first question. Maybe we'll go to you on the first one, which is, and do you think paying for income protection insurance through your super is a good idea? Alex, let's go with the more sensible sounding one, which is, does income protection through super, is that a thing? And does it sound like a good idea for some people?
Yeah. Two very different, different questions. We'll do the insurance one first. How about that? So, when we're talking to clients, when you come to see us and we discuss around, your personal insurances and whether you need any cover, how you sort of pay for that is important, because with income protection, as an example, you have the option to pay for that through your super fund, or you can pay for that personally as well. And the two things we're kind of looking at here is really, the tax deductibility of the premium. So an income protection premium will be tax deductible in a super fund and also personally. Okay, so let's just say in a hypothetical example, the premium's $1,000 for the year. Let's just say that. So mm-hmm. A super fund pays a tax rate of 15%. Okay, so the net cost of that premium inside super would be $850. Okay, because they get $150 tax deduction. Whereas outside super, say you're earning between $45,000 and $120,000 currently, your effective tax rate is 34.5%. Okay, so that $1,000 you would then put into your tax return and you would get $345 back at tax time. So the net cost paying for it out of your own money will be lower. So hopefully that makes sense. But then the other
so you're saying it's cheaper if I own it in this instance, it's cheaper if I own it in my own name, in the after-tax dollars, but I've got to pay for it out of my own pocket.
That's correct. So that's the second consideration. Well, the other consideration, should I say, not second too, is the cash flow aspect. Okay. So, because right now, again, this person could be looking to save a house, or they're wanting to put money into an investment outside super so they can generate more of a passive income in the future, so they don't have to work as much. They might have a holiday coming up. They might have young kids right now. So cash flow is tight for that reason, or again, a myriad of sort of reasons here. So that's important to consider as well, because that $1,000 may therefore be better spent elsewhere towards other goals at this point in time. And it's important to consider as well when we discuss this that your situation will change over time. So right now you may have more impending goals like getting that house deposit or building that investment or whatever it is. But in the future, maybe you've now achieved those. And you're earning more money as well, as an example. So potentially now it makes more sense to pay for income protection, not inside super anymore, potentially paying for it now outside. The other thing, if I can just mention, this is getting to the weeds a little bit, that if you do pay for it through super, let's say you opt to do that on, you're like, yep, I want to keep my cash flow as flexible as possible, so I'm going to pay for it through super. You have a good 12 months with RASC, you earn more money than you thought you were going to, so you've actually got this spare $1,000. You can always contribute that now into super, okay, which then would cover that premium, which then would give you a tax deduction at the same rate that if you personally paid for that that income protection outside super as well. That's getting a little bit more complex.
No, I love that.
You like that? Yeah, it gives you that flexibility, right? Which particularly, if you're in your 20s, 30s and 40s, in my opinion, it's good to have that flexibility.
And that's exactly what I do, mate. So I have a good income protection policy inside my super fund, but I contribute extra, and knowing since a few years ago that knowing that I can claim a tax deduction for those extra BPAY contributions that I pop in there. And it's a great way to try and get closer to the best of both worlds for me, I think, is, okay, I've got my insurance protection. I've got that all in there. And there are certain pros and cons to that as well, but it's in there. I feel protected, but hey, I don't want that policy eating away at my retirement savings. So I'm just going to pop a little bit extra in as if I normally would, which is a great way to get the best of both worlds. Now, the other part of this question from Grillbug was, is lithium still a good stock? Well, lithium isn't actually a stock. Lithium is a commodity that goes into batteries along with nickel and a few other things. And the thing about lithium, I was very blessed, Alex. Recently, I sat down with the former chief financial officer of BHP, which is the world's biggest mining company. And obviously, when you're the biggest in the world, you take a look at some of the things that you can dig out of the ground and you go, is it a good thing for me to be digging out of the ground? And in their opinion, they believe that the best commodities for them to invest in are commodities that aren't easy to dig out of the ground because they're not that common, and you can get a long runway. So a long-term runway of opportunity for that commodity. Say like iron ore is a fantastic example out your neck of the woods, mate. Iron ore is a steel-making ingredient. They pull it out of the ground in the Pilbara. They put it on a big ship, goes to China, gets made into steel that's used for decades to come. Lithium has the elements of being, no pun intended, a long-term solution for electric vehicles, battery storage, and many other things. The problem is it's one of the most abundant things on the earth. So it's actually very common. And depending on the two mining methods that are used, it actually means that supply is not a problem. So meaning that depending on whether you get it from Chile, you get it from Australia, or you get it from the Brine Valley in Germany, it doesn't really matter where you get it from. There's a lot of it. And so one of the problems that the mining companies are finding out at the moment, and investors who invest in those companies, is that there is an oversupply of lithium. And what that means is as more lithium is in the market, the price goes down because it's everywhere. And the reality is that eventually we'll find a spot where it's kind of like in equilibrium, we call it in economics, but we could be, who knows where that is. I don't know where that is exactly. I prefer to invest in companies that have a definitive future. They control their future and the product that they sell. The easiest way to think about this is when you go to the supermarket, you'll see a bunch of different baked beans on the shelf. They all are baked beans, but only one of them is Heinz. So they take the beans, put a label around it, and they call it Heinz. It's the only one. And so that is probably my spiel is I hope you have a diversified portfolio. I hope you're not just going, I'm going to swing for the fences with lithium, and then I'm going to back up the truck on my income protection policy so I can, if anything does go wrong, I've got a backstop, because that's not the way it works. But good for you for sending in this question and maintain that diversified portfolio. For everyone that asked the question this week, we will be able to get you any course on the RASC website for free. Just write in to us and say, hey, I was this person who asked the question. I'm here to redeem a free course. For example, the Value Investor Program on RASC Education is normally $500, but it's yours for free if you tell us you were the one who asked the question. So if your name's Willie, Dan, or Grillbug, write into us. Finally, Alex, at the end of every show, just quickly, I ask you to do one thing for me, and that's just to give me and everyone listening to this just one thing that we can do with our finances today. Obviously, everyone can reach out to Everest Wealth via the link in the show notes, but what's one thing you would leave people with?
Yeah, I think we'll just go off that last question about the income protection. I think a really good thing is just to make sure you have a bit of a review of that. Look at what you've got, where you're paying for it, making sure you have enough, because a lot of the time, you will have an income protection policy inside your super fund by default, but generally the benefit amount, so how much you would get paid if you got sick or injured and you couldn't work as a result, is typically very low because it's just been given to you. So making sure that you've reviewed that, and if you do value your income and you are going to sort of suffer if you can't receive an income from work because you're sick or injured, it's worthwhile making sure that benefit amount is correct. And again, as we sort of said, what structure you're paying that from. Do you pay from out of your own income, or do you continue to pay for that via super as well?
If you play contact sports on the weekend and you're a single income family, go and get income protection right now.
Particularly if you're, if you're a blue collar as well, because, you need your hands and feet typically as well.
If you're a tradie, we're talking to you. Get income protection now. Great way to end the show, mate. Thank you so much for your time. There's a link in the show notes to get in contact with the team at Everest Wealth, particularly 20s, 30s, 40s. Get in contact with Alex and the team. Mate, as always, an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Australian Finance Podcast. We hope you learned something new and were able to take one thing away from this episode.
If you're keen to learn more, head on over to RASC Education and take one of our free money and investing courses. You could even become a RASC Core member for less than your Netflix subscription each month. And don't forget to subscribe for new episodes in your inbox every week.
Plus, if you enjoyed the show, we'd love you to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and send any questions our way via the link in the description. And before we go on, did this podcast contain personal financial advice just for me?
Absolutely not, Kate. Our podcast actually contains general financial information only. What that means is the information does not take into account your financial needs, goals, objectives, or even your situation. So because of that, it's important that you consider if the information is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on it.
If that all sounds a bit confusing, or you're still working out what your needs are, it's a great idea to consult a licensed and trusted financial planner. And don't forget to do your own research.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10, and to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that RASC could help you in 2024. As many of you know, RASC has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies, which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high-growth strategy focuses on longer-term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if, you want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All Rask users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the Rask community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator Program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number 9, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the Rask YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the Rask network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask Network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.